Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, how can a window in a wall be a blessing? But opening a door could mean so much more. We go to Jerusalem to hear the story of the Catholic Kamboni sisters' peaceful struggle to keep their convent's nursery school open. And One Heart, that's the name of the Pope's very own charity office. An official there tells us more about its mission. Now, I'd like you to come with me to Jerusalem, the site of our Lord's Last Supper, his crucifixion on Mount Calvary, and his resurrection. I was there again in October 2010 and want to give you an update on a story I covered earlier in the year. I call it the story of the window in the wall, but what was once a mixed blessing is now a fond memory. My journey to see the window in the wall began with this extraordinary nun.
One day, sisters woke up in the morning and they found that the trees of the garden were all cut because they had decided that the wall would have such a line which follow the line they wanted. And we have to say that this wall really has changed our life there.
Spanish-born sister Alicia Vacas recalls the grim day in 2004 that the Catholic convent she shares with 11 other Kamboni sisters on the southern slope of the Mount of Olives became yet another casualty of the ongoing tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli soldiers appropriated convent property and began constructing what is today a section of Israel's towering 26-foot-high security wall, cutting off this part of Bethany overlooking Jerusalem from the West Bank. It was here, the place of Lazarus, as Al-Aizariya is known in Arabic, that the Gospel of John tells us Jesus rose Lazarus from the dead. The Kamboni sisters have lived there since before Israel became a state. I first visited the sisters' convent in January 2010. The wall cuts right through the convent property and takes up two sides of a tiny playground for the kindergarten that the nuns run for some 50 Palestinian children.
It means that the families of the kids of the kindergarten, they remain all on the other side. And the village of Al-Aizariya, the village of Bethany, is on the other side. The church is on the other side.
Is that the church where you go to Mass?
Yeah, this is our church. And this is our parish, let us say. In Jerusalem, there is only one parish. So this church is not, juridically, it's not a parish. But it is the church we go every week. And this is the Christian community we follow. And the families we know, we visit, and everything now is the other side of the wall. And the other way of reaching out is going to the checkpoint, which is 15 kilometers far from home.
And how long could that take you?
Well, if you go by car, it could be like half an hour, because you have to make 15 kilometers after the checkpoint and then come back. And if you go with public means, it is more than 1 hour, because you have to go to Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem you have to take another bus going all around the through the checkpoint to basically to the other side of the wall. It is like it could be 20 meters far from home. The church is not more than 50 meters far from home. But you have to go through Jerusalem and then through the checkpoint, and it takes more than 1 hour. If there are no problems in the checkpoints, because sometimes you get stuck at the checkpoint, sometimes if there are Jewish feast days, for instance, checkpoints are closed. If the situation, the political situation is unstable or is risky, checkpoints are closed, so there are so many limitations.
Sister Alicia and the other sisters are cut off from their church, and once familiar Christian processions on feasts like Palm Sunday can no longer take place. Those on the wrong side of the wall no longer have access to hospitals, schools, shops, and businesses.
It is a fact that occupation prevents religious people to reach the places of prayer for both Muslim and Christians. Palestinians from the West Bank, they cannot reach the temples or the places for prayer. Christians cannot go to the Holy Sepulchre to pray, even on feast days, like the procession you were talking about, and Muslims cannot go to Al-Aqsa in their feast days. And especially during the feast days, the roads are closed. They are not allowed to go. So it's a difficult situation for all of them. Many of them have lost their jobs because they cannot get to Jerusalem to work. And a place like Elizaria, Bethany, was mainly dependent on Jerusalem because it is so close. It was so easy for them. Most of them work on tourism or selling things to pilgrims. And so more than 60% of the families in Elizaria lost their jobs because of the wall. What has been the solution for them? For many years, they have been jumping the wall. And at the beginning of the construction of the wall, our garden was literally occupied by people who were trying to find their ways to cross the garden and reach Jerusalem. When the wall became 8 meters tall, it was impossible.
The sisters have painted brightly colored giraffes, lions, and tigers to soften the impact of the wall on the 3 to 4 year old toddlers in their care. But I wonder how successful that effort is. The solid cement structure casts a deep shadow over the little playhouse, slide, and games. Thanks to Vatican intervention, Israeli authorities opened a small window in the wall, allowing the children to return to school in 2009.
We have to say that most of the families are very poor there, and they are already supported with the school fees, so they don't have the chance of getting a bus and paying transportation for so small, so young kids every day. So the situation became very complicated, and the intervention of the Vatican ambassador, the nuncio, was a blessing for us, and he managed, I don't know how, but he managed to convince the army to open space for the kids. They promised the gate, and the gate became sort of window. I mean, it's so high, it starts more than 1.60 meters high.
Meters is 5.25 feet off the ground. When I visited, it was in time to see the nuns in their white habits take the tiny hands of these toddlers and lead them two at a time up a steep flight of metal steps to reach the open window. They were so careful with their tiny charges, not one must trip or fall, too far to drop. The scene before me was surreal, to say the least, and I was suddenly overwhelmed by an immense, an inexplicable sense of grief, the kind you feel when someone very dear to you dies. But for Sister Alicia, that staircase was a blessing.
It took a long time since they put it. So the first days we were literally lifting the kids and passing through the window.
And there's a huge drop on the other side.
Yeah. And we were using bricks, for instance, or anything just to make it a bit higher and helping
goodness.
The kids through.
And you've got the soldiers there with their machine guns.
And what
do the kids think about that situation?
Well, at the beginning it was traumatic, also because most of the kids, they have a very very difficult background and ideas on soldiers. So the first day we had the terrible experience of one child, for instance, crying and shouting he wanted the dad. And of course, families cannot pass through this as a small window. So we cannot have a real contact with the families now because they cannot come to visit us. They cannot come to take the children if they are sick. They cannot come for the feast on Mother's Day. So this child was crying. He wanted the father, daddy, daddy. So sister told him, you know, I called your father. He's coming. Just to calm him down. And he started screaming more and more. And he said, no, soldiers are here. They will shoot at him. You know, they have this impression, they are very young kids, and their image of soldiers is a very aggressive one because of their experience on checkpoints and television. And we try to make things smoother somehow, and some of the soldiers are actually very nice, and some of them are even Arab Israelis. And one of them is a Christian Arab Israeli. And some of them are very kind with the kids, and the relationship between the children and the soldiers are nice and smooth. But it is a traumatic situation in any case. and it is so ridiculous. I mean, if you see the kids jumping through the window and waiting for hours, sometimes the soldiers forget to come and open, because this window is open 15 minutes at 8 o'clock in the morning and 15 minutes at midday. So quite often they just forget, or they are late, they have other business, and they come 1 hour later. So having the kids there under the window waiting for them to come is so ridiculous. So it doesn't make any sense.
Well, what happened next in this ongoing story really doesn't make any sense to me. The window in the wall disappeared over the summer, making it next to impossible for the sisters to reopen the nursery. The immense irony is that where the little window once hung now stands a towering sliding gate for the passage of vehicles, a man-sized door for pedestrians, a new guard tower, and what looks like a document processing center for walkthroughs, complete with in and out turnstiles. In sum, it is easy to understand why the sisters were relieved they would no longer have to subject the toddlers to the steep climb up to the window and down the other side.
When they put this big gate, and we saw that everything was put in order in such a way that this big gate, in one way or the other, has to be open. It's functioning, actually. We saw it opening. We saw also this small door. So we say, okay, that is the door of the children. And also the parents on the other side, they thought so.
Italian sister Fulgida Gasparini breathes a sigh of frustration. The new gate remains closed, and the mixed blessing of the window in the wall, for her, is now a fond memory. According to the Apostolic Nuncio, Archbishop Antonio Franco, who has been negotiating the opening of the gate with Israeli authorities, it won't be opening anytime soon. Some have told the sisters the gate will never open.
We had a meeting with the military authorities early in September, and we were announced that this year the door would not open.
The Vatican's ambassador notes the Comboni sisters had received assurances from Israeli authorities when the wall was being constructed that they would be given access for the children.
But the military were saying that there is a danger of security, and I was arguing there is no danger, that we can also get the help, the collaboration on the other side to have the movement of the children without any problem. But in any case, they offered that will facilitate the transit of the bus. But the parents did not want the little children to be transported by bus.
Parents, first of all, they say kids so young, every day on the checkpoint, they see things that really, at times, they are also nasty.
Most of the parents from the wrong side of the wall were unwilling or simply couldn't afford to send their toddlers by bus, an hour-long journey each way through an armed military checkpoint. I don't think I'd have the courage to put my 3 or 4-year-old through such an ordeal. The 10 children whose parents did accept the option are accompanied by 2 teachers. They drive up to the checkpoint in their Palestinian van, get out, and pass the soldiers armed with automatic weapons, often, but not always, given priority over others waiting in the line. Once on the other side, they have to walk to another Israeli-licensed minibus, which will finally bring them to the convent nursery.
So for the parents to take a Palestinian minibus to reach a certain point, to get the Israeli minibus to come in, you know, for them it's an expense that they cannot afford. To come to the nursery school, it's impossible for parents who cannot afford even to pay the school fee of the children. And then, you know, you have also to see the type of facilitation, because when they say, we facilitate, who is we? Because every day you have new personnel at the checkpoint. So one day you meet the one who says, oh yes, I know, these are the children, go. Another day you have somebody who tells you, stop there, children down, and let's see what it is. It's not so easy at the checkpoint. You know, there are also experiences made by the sisters who are working with Rabbi for peace.
Rabbis for human rights.
They go out to the villages to meet people who have no access to medicine, to the dispensary, to the hospital, and so on. But when things are very serious, for instance, when a mother is about to deliver and there are problems, if you have to pass the checkpoint and things are not in order, the women stay there. Somebody can stay there 8 hours before being admitted to Victoria Hospital here up. You have to wait. We had a sister who became sick when we had the checkpoint here. She could not go to the hospital. We asked them just to remove a barrier to get the car in. They refused. They say no. And she had to go around and so on. You know. By the time that she was at the hospital, she was in coma. Surely they don't help, you know, when you have this experience, no?
Of the 55 children enrolled for the scholastic year 2010-2011, only half can now attend. Just a fifth of them are able to make what was once the 5-minute journey through the wall from the wrong side. The Kamboni Sisters' kindergarten and home for spiritual retreats is an oasis of peace in an angry land. A caring place full of love, reconciliation, and just plain goodness.
You cannot generalize, you cannot say everybody is bad, you cannot say, okay, Israel is bad and Palestinians are good and so on. If you speak with the people, I'm sure that the majority of the Israeli people are not in agreement with this wall. And there are so many journalists, also women, who come here to see what is happening and so on. So it means that not everybody accepts that this wall is there as a protective wall.
Am I crazy to believe that if a window in a wall can be a blessing in disguise, the opening of a door can open hearts and minds in a never-ending conflict that has bred hatred and wounded so many souls? Only time will tell. It means one heart. That's the translation from Latin of Cor Unum, the pontifical council that coordinates the Pope's charitable contributions to help victims of disasters and fund such projects as combating desertification in Africa and aiding farm workers and indigenous people in Latin America and the Caribbean. The council has given millions of dollars in the Pope's name for victims of earthquakes, flooding, and other catastrophes. The Council is also responsible for preparing the Holy Father's Lenten message each year. Well, Pope Paul VI established the Council in 1971, saying, "A heart that beats in rhythm with the heart of Christ, whose pity for the hungry multitudes reaches them even in their spiritual hunger." Pope John Paul II once told Cor Unum staff,
"You are, in a certain sense, the eye that spots the multiple poverties. You are the heart that has compassion and wants to do for the other who is in need what one would wish for oneself. You are the hand that is stretched out fraternally and gives practical help."
In his encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict XVI wrote,
"The Church, as God's family, must be a place where help is given and received, and at the same time a place where people are also prepared to serve those outside her confines who are in need of help."
Cor Unum's Monsignor Anthony Figueredo told me more about the Council's activities, including coming concretely to the aid of Haitians who continue to suffer so greatly from a devastating quake that destroyed much of Port-au-Prince in January 2010.
Many people think that we're a fundraising agency, that we collect money and we give it out. That's really not our principal work. The diocese do that very well. I think of Haiti and in the United States, when the earthquake took place in Haiti, the diocese raised an enormous amount of money, which we wouldn't be able to do ourselves. I mean, we're a small office, there's 14 of us here. So how could we possibly raise money for Haiti? So our main work, Tracy, is really to maintain the splendor of Christian charity, and that's through the work of catechesis. So meeting with bishops, because bishops are the first responsible for charity in their diocese, through the ad limina visits, through visits to the episcopal conferences, through visits to the Catholic charitable organizations, through various literature. We're responsible for the Lenten message. So that work of catechesis. On a second level, there are needs. We receive letters from people in need, and then there are the major tragedies, like Haiti, like Pakistan. So whatever need there is placed before us, we assess it, and we say, in the name of the Holy Father, can we give a small sign of compassion in his name? I mean, it's not large amounts. I think the amounts are very small, but it means a lot. You know, someone who's in Nepal and needs has had a tragedy, a humanitarian disaster, and receives a letter, receives some very small funding from the Holy Father, it really gives them hope. It opens heaven for them. It gives them an insight into the love of God through the church.
Does Pope Benedict ever get personally involved in any of these projects, or does he step down the road and say, listen, I've got this project in mind and I really want somebody to do something about it?
Pope Benedict's papacy, if we look at his speeches, addresses, homilies, Cantus Firmus, a thread which runs through his papacy, is charity, the need to love God and love our neighbor. So he's very much involved on that level. Whenever there is a major tragedy, he often speaks about this, and he works really through us, asking us to make sure that the needs are met. Sometimes also there are very specific requests made to him, and I have to say that the Holy Father personally sometimes says, I want you to act, to respond in my name to that particular need. So I think on his papal visits, very much, he always, almost always, has a place for those who are suffering. I think in England, he visited an old people's home, you know, in many places in the United States, other places he'd visit children who are disabled. A very key part of the papacy, Tracy, is charity and this love that manifests the charity of Christ. So yes, very much involved, and I think above all, through his own prayer.
It's come out several times, the fact that Catholic charities are able to contribute almost 85-90% of the donations they receive actually to fund the projects. So their administrative costs are very low, and you compare that to some of these big, weighty international organizations, not to name names, but their administrative costs are very, very high. How do the Catholic charities keep their budgets so tight?
I think the key is we have wonderful, zealous, dedicated personnel, workers, many volunteers too. If we look at the Catholic Church, and it's really present in dioceses, we already have a network present, and we still have religious congregations, we still have priests, we still have sisters, we still have lay people dedicated. So many of the new ecclesial movements, communities, are very much engaged in charity and do not do this for themselves, but do it out of love of God. So obviously there is payment for those who have jobs, but they're very often prepared to do this as simply out of the love of their hearts. And the reward is not so much on the monetary level. It's really the reward of serving the other. That's where our happiness lies, Tracy. And God made us not to live for ourselves, but to live for the other, to give of ourselves for the other. And that's where we discover the greatest reward, not only in heaven, but in this life. And when people discover that, they're prepared to give everything. One sees the witness of the great saints, you know, St. Vincent de Paul, Mother Teresa, Francis Cabrini, so many of the saints, they gave everything, they left everything for love of God. And, you know, I go and visit the Sisters of Mother Teresa here in Rome, I celebrate Mass, and I've never met people who are so happy. You know, they've never met, and they have very little. Obviously, they don't get paid, they refuse donations in many ways, but they're the happiest people one could meet. Why? Because in giving, we receive. That's what St. Francis says. We need to do that to discover the great reward is the love of God in us.
What are some of the projects? You mentioned Haiti, you mentioned Pakistan. Once a disaster strikes like this, is the Catholic Church able to assist these people on a longer-term basis?
Just to give the example of Haiti, when the disaster struck, the Holy Father asked Corunum to coordinate the relief efforts. How have we helped? There's the immediate need. Waters, sanitation, preventing disease. So that's an immediate need. There's also the longer-term need, and we've really moved now, even though there are obviously still difficulties. You know, cholera is breaking out there now. But there's a longer-term need of reconstruction. And there were significant funds given to Haiti, never enough. But the issue now is how do we coordinate that reconstruction so it's not just haphazard. So, for example, an agency has just been established by the Haitian Episcopal Conference with the help of other Episcopal conferences, principally the American Bishops' Conference, to coordinate the reconstruction of houses, churches, centers, make sure that the funds that were given generously are put to the best use. So that involves architects, it involves bricklayers, it involves buying the cement, but we need to use wisely what others have given to us. And then, you know, there is an accountability. We are stewards. We need to be good stewards of that which has been given to us, but there also needs to be coordination. And so that's really our work, and so we oversee a lot of that work.
In a country like Pakistan, where we saw the terrible flooding, how do you strike the right balance between, it's a mostly Muslim country, so between witnessing to the Catholic, to the Christian faith, and providing charity in an ambiance which is primarily Muslim or Buddhist, whatever have you?
We meet the immediate need. There's a flood, people who are suffering, so charity is not partisan to a religious faith, it's not partisan to culture or color or creed. But every act of charity carries within itself Christ, because charity, it's a Christian term, which means the love of God. Caritas means the love of God. And so when we diffuse that charity, it always carries within itself a message of evangelization. People who saw Mother Teresa saw the love of God. And it doesn't mean we proselytize, it doesn't mean we make them Christians, but already there they meet Jesus, and if that also means that they want to know what gives you your love, well, where do you get it from, what is your source, we are very happy to do that. You know, in the early church, the way people became Christians, converted to the faith in a pagan environment, and we live very much in a pagan environment today, was see how they love each other. They saw what the Christians had, and they wanted it. And so that's our big challenge today, to love our neighbor. That's what makes Christianity different, to love the one who is different to us, to love the one who doesn't share our views, doesn't share our religion. You know, Jesus gave two signs, Tracy, and he says, by this way, people will know you are my disciples. What were the two signs? Love one another as I have loved you. It wasn't simply love one another. It was love as I and Jesus loved to the end on the cross. No other religion loves the enemy as Jesus did. And the other sign, may they be one, Father, as you and I as one, where there is that unity. What does that mean? Where the other is different to me, I can still be in communion with them. It underlines so much of the church's teaching, for example, on marriage, on disabilities, on euthanasia, on I can still accept the other and give myself to the other, even though they're different to me.
Monsignor Anthony Figueiredo is an official at the Pontifical Council Cor Unum. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.